This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 14th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, activists from Mexico and the U.S. begin a peace caravan across the country to draw attention to rising violence from international drug policy. Advocates call on the new head of the Nuclear Regulatory Agency to make major safety changes at the nation's plants. And after another deadly shooting, this time in Texas, advocates call for concrete action at the federal level to reduce gun violence. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. In his first public remarks since his defection last week, former Syrian Prime Minister Riyad Hijab said today that President Bashar al-Assad only controls about 30% of the country and the government is nearing collapse.
I confirm that the regime is decaying, morally, financially, and economically. It's also militarily deteriorating.
Hijab encouraged international opposition to unify and added that he doesn't intend to accept any political posts in the future. The U.S. Treasury Department lifted sanctions against Hijab today, citing his defection and encouraging other senior Syrian officials to do the same. In London, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a UK-based NGO, updated their estimate of the death toll during the uprising to 23,000. In other Syrian news, Reporters Without Borders issued an open letter to leaders of two Syrian opposition groups, imploring them to ensure the safety of pro-government media. Citing recent executions of two reporters, the group called for the release of all detained media and the cessation of forced statements. Tensions between police and youth in northern France exploded into rioting last night in the worst outbreak of unrest in France's impoverished suburban neighborhood since 2005. From France, Liam Moriarty has more.
An estimated 100 youths clashed with riot police overnight in a poor, largely immigrant neighborhood in the city of Amiens, about 90 miles north of Paris. At least 16 police officers were reportedly injured, and a nursery school and a community gym were severely burned, along with a number of cars. French media report the incident was triggered by a police traffic stop that was seen as insensitive by locals attending the funeral of a young man who died in a motorbike accident. Like the nationwide riots in 2005, tensions between suburban youths and police are rooted in persistent poverty and high unemployment in the immigrant neighborhoods that surround many French cities. Many residents say they're treated with disrespect and discriminated against by the police and government officials. The district where the rioting took place last night was recently designated by the government as one of 15 troubled areas targeted for heightened police presence. French President François Hollande condemned the violence and pledged to do what was necessary to maintain order. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
A study published today in the journal Scientific Reports says that radiation from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster most likely caused genetic mutations in butterflies. The second generation of insects that were in their larval stage when the disaster struck have a high rate of small wings, malformed antennae, and disfigured appendages. Egyptian authorities temporarily reopened the Rafah border crossing with Gaza today, Rami El-Maghari reports.
The Rafah crossing terminal, the main gateway to the outside world for 1.6 million Gazans, was reopened earlier today, but only partially. The terminal will only be open through Thursday and only for Palestinians seeking medical care in Egypt, those holding residency permits in other Arab countries, and students, Gazans hoping to perform the Umrah pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia ahead of the Al-Fitr Eid holidays, will not be allowed to cross. Egyptian authorities closed the terminal last Sunday following a deadly attack on the Egyptian side of the border. The attack killed 16 soldiers and injured 7 others. Today, violence in the Sinai region continued as Egyptian forces seeking a suspect in Sunday's attack traded gunfire with militants near the Sheikh Zayed village. Also today, a high-level advisor to Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi told the Egyptian daily Al-Masr Al-Yom that Morsi is considering negotiations with Israel about increasing Egypt's military presence in the Sinai Peninsula. This comes shortly after Morsi fired the nation's longtime military leader, Mohamed Tantawi, in what some observers call a soft coup. Rami Al-Mighari, AFAS Iran, Cairo.
Another strong tremor struck in Iran's East Azerbaijan province today as search and rescue efforts were renewed following two earthquakes over the weekend. Two survivors were pulled from the rubble today, but rescuers have yet to reach many remote villages in the quake zone. Authorities had stopped searching and had refused offers of international aid, but reversed those decisions today. According to U.S. State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland, U.S. citizens can make donations to aid efforts without violating U.S. sanctions in place against Iran. The Iranian Red Crescent says they have provided temporary shelter to 50,000 people. The death toll stands at 306, but may rise. And voters in four states are at the polls today, casting ballots in primaries and local races. Connecticut, Florida, Minnesota, and Wisconsin will all name congressional contenders in the November general elections. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Activists from Mexico and the U.S. have launched a caravan for peace across the nation to raise awareness of what they call a failed drug war in both countries. The caravan was launched in Tijuana over the weekend and is scheduled to arrive in Washington, D.C. on September 10th. During the Los Angeles stop, victims, family members, and Mexican celebrities denounced drug policy on both sides of the border that they say has led to the killings, disappearances, and displacement of tens of thousands. From KPFK in Los Angeles, Ernesto Arce reports.
Social justice advocates join the family members of more than 80 victims of Mexico's drug war who are taking part in the Caravan for Peace and Justice with Dignity. Ana Perez is with Presente.org, a Latino advocacy organization.
We're here to put the pain and suffering of over 60,000 Mexicans, and so we're here to show their faces and to hear their stories.
The movement's symbolic leader is well-known Mexican poet Javier Sicilia. In March 2011, his son Juan Francisco was murdered along with six others, their bodies showing signs of torture.
Se menciona mucho mi nombre.
I hear a lot just mention my name, but I want to say that it's not just me, it's all of us, with many others.
Since President Felipe Calderon took office in 2006, more than 60,000 people have been killed in drug war violence. Thousands are missing and tens of thousands displaced. Mexican actress Kate del Castillo translated a speech written by Cecilia about how both Mexican and U.S. drug policies are responsible for the cross-border violence.
Especially when it comes to such an absurd war as the one against drugs. Death, humiliation, illegal trade of guns, money laundering, criminalization, corruption, fear, horror, prisons, the strengthening of crime and government violence. We refer to it as the crisis of democracy, the annihilation of freedoms, and the contempt for immigrants. A burden that seems more than we can bear.
Cecilia's Caravan for Peace has partnered with more than 100 U.S.-based groups, including the NAACP, Global Exchange, and the Drug Policy Alliance, which calls for an end to drug prohibition. The coalition wants to raise awareness of the price of the drug war that organizers say has cost the U.S. over $1 trillion since it was launched by the Richard Nixon administration in the 1970s. Maribel Asuncion is a Los Angeles resident who suspects her brother was kidnapped in Mexico. He is one of an estimated 10,000 people who have gone missing since President Felipe Calderon unleashed the military against drug cartels.
My brother has been disappeared for a year and a half. My mom has knocked on so many doors and all Mexican authorities. And it is only now we have been able to accomplish in this time.
According to the Movement for Peace with Justice and Dignity, only 2% of all crimes committed in Mexico are investigated and solved. Without help from the government, Asuncion says victims of drug war violence and their families must organize themselves and anyone else willing to help.
Solo pido a toda la comunidad latina.
I ask of the Latina community to join in this pain, because it's not just my pain, but it's all of our pain. And to be able to search for them, because we can see that our authorities are not going to help us.
The caravan will make 25 stops in U.S. cities before arriving in Washington, D.C. in September to lobby Congress members. They'll be asking lawmakers to curb the flow of assault weapons into Mexico, stop the militarization of drug enforcement, and end what they call U.S. prohibition policies. Ernesto Arce, FSRN, Los Angeles.
Today, a woman in Houston, Texas, is in serious condition at an area hospital after being hit by a stray bullet in a shooting that killed three people, including the gunman, and wounded three others. Police in College Station said an investigation is ongoing after a man opened fire when authorities tried to serve him an eviction notice. The shooting took place just blocks from Texas A&M University, where some of the 50,000 students are preparing to begin classes this month. Neighbors said they found bullet holes as far as two blocks from the site of the shooting. One witness described the incident to local station KXAN.
First round is like 5-6 shots. We wait for 30 seconds later, another 5-6 shots. It was just like an automatic gun going off. And it was going off for about 30 minutes.
College Station Police Chief Jeff Capps confirmed that one of those killed was Constable Brian Bachman, who was serving the eviction notice.
We live in a community where our law enforcement agencies, we work hand in hand with each other. And Constable Bachman, we worked real well with him. He had the highest of integrity, and his loss will be felt deeply within the community.
The Texas shooting is just the latest in several high-profile incidents of gun violence across the country. In July, a shooting at a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, killed 12 and injured more than 50. Earlier this month, an attack at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, killed six and wounded several. Pressure is mounting on political leaders following the murders. The Brady campaign is calling on presidential candidates to address gun laws and violence in an upcoming debate. Monday, the group released a letter to Jim Lehrer, who is scheduled to moderate the first debate in Denver, urging him to confront President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney on the issue. Every day, 32 people are killed by guns across the U.S., according to the Brady campaign and the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. For more, we're joined by Benjamin Houghton, managing attorney with the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He joins us from San Francisco, California. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
Now, according to police in College Station, Texas, where the shooting yesterday took place, authorities recovered long guns and a pistol. It's still not confirmed exactly what kind of weapon was used. But let's start with Texas. Is it correct that in Texas there is no waiting period and no state registration for firearms?
That is correct, yeah. Texas has adopted some firearms laws, but not very many. You know, it's important to understand that states have to step in because there are very few federal gun laws in this country. And as a result, it's up to the states. Unfortunately, most states have not adopted what wide majorities of the American public support as really common sense laws.
As we said, this is just the latest in a high-profile shooting following the shooting in Aurora. And after that one, President Obama did note the dangers and gaps in federal background check system on weapons. He also said, quote, AK-47s belong in the hands of soldiers, not criminals. That's from a speech talking to the Urban League after that shooting. But beyond rhetoric, what could he or other legislators do now on a federal level?
Well, you know, there are real gaps in federal gun laws, and the president definitely identified two of the really major areas. In terms of background checks, federal law only requires a person to have a background check done when they buy a gun from a licensed firearm dealer. If you buy a gun from a person who's not a licensed dealer, you know, a private seller, you don't, under federal law, have to have a background check done, and it's estimated that around 40% of firearm sales are done through these private sales. You know, this is a major gap in federal law that needs to be addressed. Additionally, the regulation of assault weapons. You know, federal law used to prohibit the sale of assault weapons and large capacity magazines, but that ban expired after 10 years and was not reenacted. And I think it, you know, that's another thing that federal law could. The federal government, you know, definitely should address.
Well, we noted the response from President Obama after Aurora. After the shooting in Texas yesterday, Republican presumed presidential nominee Mitt Romney did respond. He said that he didn't think gun laws are the answer. And he said, quote, "It's not the matter of the weapon that's used. It's the matter of the individuals and the choices these people make." Your response to his view?
Well, I think if we want to focus on the people, I mean, first of all, I'd say that, you know, that certain firearms are certainly, you know, military-style weapons. You know, assault weapons are designed to cause a mass chaos. But if we are going to focus on the people, you know, there is a lot that can be done to strengthen our background check system. That you know, upwards of 90% of Americans are in favor of a number of common sense restrictions involving background checks, you know, preventing the mentally ill from accessing firearms through the use of a strong background check system. I mean, this is stuff that transcends party affiliation. You know, this is really basic stuff to the American people. If we are going to focus on keeping guns out of the wrong hands, you know, people who really could do some serious injury and harm with them, you know, we need to strengthen the background check system, period.
Well, you cited the number of 90% of people favoring some kind of action like that. On the other hand, there's the National Rifle Association. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, between 2001 and 2010, the NRA spent between $1.5 and $2.7 million on lobbying at the federal level. And then during the 2010 election cycle, NRA spent some more than $7 million on independent expenditures at the federal level. That's mostly on Republican candidates. Talk about the influence of the NRA on this issue.
Well, the NRA is certainly opposed to any steps in the right direction. I mean, we know that, you know. But I think the influence of the NRA is overstated. You know, I think what matters here is not so much the power of the NRA, but what happens when the NRA is the only voice that legislators are hearing from. You know, it's important for those of us who are concerned about the safety of our communities and are concerned about this gun violence crisis that we're facing to contact our legislators. You know, it's important for them to hear that this is an issue that matters to us, because they're going to hear from the NRA because of its funding and its ties to the gun industry. It's, you know, it's a very well-funded lobbying group, but you know, if they hear from those of us who are concerned about gun violence as well, you know, that makes a difference.
Benjamin Van Houten is managing attorney with the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Rising seawater temperatures caused the shutdown of a reactor at a major nuclear power plant on the East Coast this week, and scientists say more plants could be at risk as the climate continues to heat up and the current drought shrinks inland water sources. The shutdown of the Unit 2 reactor at Connecticut's Millstone plant comes just 1 week after a federal court decision forced the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to suspend all new and renewed licenses for nuclear plants until the agency can craft a plan for the safe long-term storage of radioactive used fuel. Environmental advocates are calling on the NRC's new chair to make major safety changes at plants around the country. In Washington, D.C., FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Seawater temperatures in the northeastern U.S. are higher than normal this year, after an unusually mild winter followed by a record-breaking hot summer. When the water from the Long Island Sound used to cool Connecticut's Millstone nuclear plant exceeded the limit of 75 degrees, the Dominion Power subsidiary moved Monday to shut one of the units down. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission was quick to respond. At a press conference in Washington, D.C. Tuesday, recently confirmed NRC Chair Allison McFarlane said the news motivated the agency to study global warming threats more closely.
It's not the first time this has occurred. Water outlet gets warm enough to cause a plant to shut down for a little while. But I have actually asked the staff to look into the issue of what are some of the potential climate change impacts that are coming down the road. One of them is the issue of water sources, output water sources, getting warm.
The nation's nuclear power plants depend on massive amounts of water, both to cool their reactors and pools of radioactive waste. The heated and often toxic water is then treated and dumped back into nearby lakes, rivers, and oceans. Environmental advocates have long opposed this so-called once-through-cooling process for destroying aquatic life and contaminating groundwater. Jim Warren with the Waste Awareness and Reduction Network, a nuclear watchdog group in North Carolina, said the process has also proved itself too vulnerable to droughts and heat waves.
Water is the Achilles heel of the nuclear power industry. When lake and river levels are running low and when they are hot during these heat waves, there simply isn't enough cooling water to do the job. And in a world where our climate is warming even more and when we're being hit by extensive heat waves and droughts, it creates a very large uncertainty as to whether coal and nuclear plants will be reliable through these hot summers, increasingly hot summers.
Warm water is also one of the many challenges facing the more than 75 pools of spent nuclear fuel around the country, which collectively hold about 65,000 tons of waste. The spent fuel pools are also vulnerable to earthquakes, fires, and other extreme weather events. For many years, politicians and nuclear executives pushed for the creation of a massive permanent nuclear waste repository inside Nevada's Yucca Mountain, but the project was defunded and put on hold in 2010 after scientists raised concerns about rainwater leakage and earthquakes at the site. At Tuesday's press conference, McFarlane promised to keep an open mind about Yucca Mountain as the NRC investigates the safe storage of radioactive waste, an issue she said has been too long ignored.
The back end of the fuel cycle matters. We should be thinking about the back end of the fuel cycle all the time. It shouldn't be an afterthought. From my point of view, it has largely been an afterthought, and I want to bring a focus to that now.
McFarlane took the helm of the commission in early July, just after a federal appeals court found the agency in violation of the National Environmental Policy Act for continuing to approve new plants and renew the licenses of old ones without a comprehensive plan for storing the radioactive waste. The agency must now halt the approval of all licenses indefinitely until such a plan is crafted. Nuclear power expert Daniel Hirsch at the University of California, Santa Cruz, told FSRN the decision is decades overdue.
The NRC years ago issued a waste confidence decision that said, in effect, we're confident that there'll be a solution. Therefore, keep producing more high-level waste, even though there is no solution as to how to dispose of it. This stuff's amazingly toxic. It's dangerous for 500,000 years. If you got within a few feet of it, it would give you a lethal dose in just a few minutes. And you have to keep it out of the human environment for thousands of generations.
The Obama administration set up the Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future in 2010 to make recommendations on spent fuel storage, earthquake hazards, and other concerns. One of the favored solutions in their 2012 final report was creating several temporary nuclear waste storage sites around the country until lawmakers and scientists chose a permanent underground location. The commission's members, including McFarlane, argue that constructing these interim sites would be good practice for building a permanent facility. But Hirsch called this a nutty proposal that puts current and future generations at risk.
The one thing you really don't want to do is move irradiated fuel twice. It's incredibly dangerous to ship it by highway or by rail. If there were a fire, if there were a terrorist attack, this is, you know, basically a mobile Chernobyl, each one of these shipments.
In response to the court ruling, the NRC could write a waste disposal rule that would apply to all new and existing plants, or it could mandate waste procedures on a case-by-case basis. McFarlane said the agency will announce a path forward in a few weeks. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
An abandoned library in Oakland was transformed briefly on Monday when community activists took over the space and began taking book donations for what they called a people's library. But less than 24 hours later, police moved in and cleared the space. FSRN's Andrew Stelzer reports that the Victor Martinez People's Library was the latest in a string of community-led occupations, focusing on government-owned properties that many say aren't properly serving the public.
Miller Avenue in East Oakland's Fruitvale neighborhood is normally pretty deserted, but on Monday afternoon, dozens of people sat on the steps of a century-old building. 14-year-old Austin was one of a group of kids making signs announcing a 6 p.m. dinner and celebration to mark the opening of the Victor Martinez People's Library, named after the late Mexican-American author.
I didn't know where the closest library was, but I guess now I do. if this is going to be a lot closer.
Inside, Jaime Silva gives a tour of the two rooms that were opened up to the public since activists entered the building at 7 a.m.
So people brought these books this morning, and since then, people from the community have been bringing more books. And so we've got this nice, these great bookshelves that are like, you know, these are about 90 years old that came with the building.
It's not surprising that the community would support the rehabilitation of this building, which hasn't been a functioning library since the 1970s. This low-income neighborhood has long been under-resourced and plagued by violence. Walking by with his little sister, Jovan Manzano says it would be good to see the building, still covered in graffiti tags and often littered with mattresses and trash, go to some good use.
I think it's pretty good. Well, yeah, to keep up the violence, to get people interested in books.
I talked to at least 5 or 6 adults that are down to bring their kids to be a part of this. We have the community support.
Francesca Carreras Velez went door to door getting the word out.
The abounding response from the community is, we've been trying to get that library from the city of Oakland for 10 years now. It's been a part of this plan, this 5-year plan the city of Oakland keeps spinning to them, and has spun it to them twice. And so I guess last week there was a community meeting about this place. And so when I talked to one woman, she was so excited. She took extra flyers. She wants to pass them out. They are ready to have this be a library/community center.
As book donations streamed in throughout the day, hopes were high. But before midnight, police moved in, cleared the building, and barred the doors once again. The People's Library is the latest in a series of actions reclaiming publicly owned spaces in and around Oakland. In May, activists began farming a plot of land owned by the University of California at Berkeley. After 3 weeks, law enforcement evicted them. In June, parents who were upset about the forced closing of their children's school camped out at Lakeview Elementary for 2 weeks until the site was broken up by police.
It's related. I mean, definitely Lakeview was a response to the kind of austerity logic that cities all over the country are applying to the people who live in the city, that like, we don't have enough money to keep schools open in neighborhoods, kids have to bus to go somewhere else, we can't keep this up. And meanwhile, you look at the budget and 40% of the budget is spent on police.
Jaime Silva was also involved in the elementary school occupation.
And this is the kind of casualty you see. Fewer libraries, more buildings that aren't adding life to the communities that they are sitting in the middle of. Well, this library once held this community together, and as you can see, this is an embattled community. It's a community struggling against all kinds of social issues that something like a library right in the middle of the community can really help to turn around.
Following the late-night raid on the library, activists are spending Tuesday regrouping and discussing their next steps. Had the city allowed them to stay, the People's Library would have been one of only 2 open today. The city has shut down the 16 branches 1 or 2 days a week because of budget cuts. Andrew Stelzer, FSRN, Oakland.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Zane Carisley. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marino.